Do you feel like you maybe pay too much for your internet? Do you even get to choose from more than one provider? Maybe you're in a rural area and reliable internet access isn't a real option for you. If you feel like we should be doing better than that by now, our next guest agrees with you.
She says fiber optic connections could transform what we know as a connected society and completely change the way we live and work. With many Asian and Northern European countries already relying on fiber to deliver and send their data, America has fallen behind.
Susan Crawford is a professor at Harvard Law School. She served as special assistant to the president for science, technology, and innovation policy in 2009. She's the author of many books, including her latest. It's called Fiber, The Coming Tech Revolution and Why America Might Miss It. Susan, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thanks so much, Rob. I appreciate being here.
Now, let's start with the technology, because this is a huge part of your book. Compare fiber optic cables as a system of internet delivery to all the other stuff that we have out there.
Well, what's amazing about fiber, it's just about magical, is that as far as we can tell, its capacity to carry data is unlimited. All you have to do once the glass is in the ground is upgrade the electronics at one end and the other. And you can say it's like a 15-mile-wide river compared to a little trickle of water for a traditional copper line. It's amazing. And it effectively creates for people just a glass wall between you and the rest of the world, a window, really, so that you can have eye contact and be present with people who are distant from you. We've never experienced that in the United States, but it's common in other countries.
Yeah, in the United States, I think we like to think of ourselves as pretty cutting edge. There's a new technology, a railroad, electricity, whatever. We're the first to get it. This is not the case. You've been traveling around the world to research this. What are other countries doing that we're not?
Well, it is shocking. And I've never been embarrassed to be an American. I'm very proud to be an American. But when I went to South Korea, and the Koreans told me that coming to America is like taking a rural vacation because life is so unconnected here. And the mayor of Stockholm grabbed me by the elbow and said, is there anything we can do to help? So basically what's happened is in the many Asian countries and several Northern European ones, this has just been like electricity or like a railroad, something that needs to connect the entire country. And there have been huge efforts on the policy level to ensure that every home and business is connected to fiber. And the real threat here is that China plans to connect 80% of their homes to fiber optic cable, which means they basically have very, very cheap, basically ubiquitous and unlimited connectivity. So new industries and new ways of making a living will come from those countries and not from the United States, which makes no sense. I mean, we should be looking the rest of the world in the rearview mirror. We're the ones who came up with the whole idea of the internet. But because of a series of policy failures over the last 20 years, we've ended up just not really relevant on the communications screen with the rest of the world, and it's particularly in Asia and Northern Europe.
Before we dig into those policy questions, I want to take a little sidebar here, something you address in your book, something I've talked to you about in the past. People might think, well, I've got a phone, I get my internet wirelessly. What do I care about fibers?
Well, that's exactly what people said when they only had enough electricity for a single light bulb in their house. You know, they used to call the electrical bill the light bill. No one thought about all the other things that could be connected to that electrical line. Things like refrigeration, even kitchen cooking, that was all a mystery to a lot of people, and particularly in rural areas and also in poor parts of urban areas. It took a long time for electricity to get there. And when it arrived in the form of a single light bulb, people might have said, well, that's enough. I don't need anything else. Turns out you need a lot to live in the modern world. And so we make sure that every house has sort of the equivalent of a fiber optic connection when it comes to electricity. You've got enough to be a member of the 21st century. That's part of the National Electric Code. But we don't have those kinds of requirements for homes and businesses. And so what's happening is we're relegating a lot of rural people and a lot of poor people in urban areas to the equivalent of a bike path when people in China will be on a superhighway.
Talking to Susan Crawford, her new book is called Fiber, The Coming Tech Revolution and Why America Might Miss It. Susan, you point the finger at one major culprit or a group of them, the companies that provide our internet currently. They're monopolies in many areas. They've had a lot of policy sway. Can you talk about those companies and how they've affected the internet we have access to?
Look, these aren't bad companies. They are great American firms like Comcast and Charter and AT&T. But for the last 15 years or so, they've been completely unrestrained, and which means they're under no obligation to serve everybody when it comes to high-speed internet access. There are certainly no price limitations. But what they'll do in this instance, just because this is the way capitalism works, is they will choose particularly rich areas and wire them with second-class service, and they're under no particular pressure to upgrade it, and then carve up markets among themselves. And that's why, in most areas, you've basically got a cable company that never competes with any other cable company, and perhaps a couple wireless offers, but not a lot of competition. And that also happened with railroads, where you have these infrastructure elements of the economy that require enormous upfront investment. It really only makes sense for one operator to be present in a particular locality and to create competition by forcing that operator to share their lines. That's the way we've always done it with telecom in the past. But where you have no rules, which is what's going on in the United States right now, the private operators will just divide up the market among themselves and then charge as much as they can get away with to the markets they decide to serve. So what we're left with is pretty, as you described, pretty monopolized urban sector, mostly cable there, and very little investment in capital to upgrade their networks to fiber. A lot of rural areas completely left out or perhaps being pushed towards unreliable wireless connections, and a whole country that is essentially paying rent to about four or five companies because of the absence of any policy in this area.
You also point towards some local initiatives as you see as bright spots where local governments have taken the initiative in getting high-speed internet. I want you to take us to Chattanooga, Tennessee, maybe not a place we think about that often from here in Wisconsin. You say they've done a lot of stuff. What's going on there?
Chattanooga has, and that's a nice mid-sized town, about 300,000 people. They use their municipal electric provider to use those same lines to provide fiber optic across the city. And now they're providing 10 gigabit symmetric service. That means equal uploads and downloads at a pretty low price to people in that city. And what's happened as a result is that they're seeing all kinds of new businesses show up and new ways of making a living there in Chattanooga, which used to be the dirtiest city in America, by the way. And they're now pivoting to take on other issues that are of a piece with this inequality in internet access, things like terrible education outcomes and health issues, and really making sure that their high school graduates are ready to take those jobs in advanced manufacturing that have come to Chattanooga because of it. But look, you've got a wonderful example right there in Wisconsin, which is not that far from Madison, Reedsburg. They were the first place in America, I believe, to offer routinely offer gigabit service to their subscribers, again, based on a municipal electric utility. They had a proud history of providing electricity to everybody and then just pivoted to fiber. And so, as I understand it, for about $45 a month, you can get gigabit service in Reedsburg, particularly if you bundle it with telephone and other services. And the customer service is great. There's a local person who answers the phone. It's a beloved service. Same thing in Chattanooga. This is a whole new way of doing things. And especially as I, you know, turn on the radio and hear about the 33rd consecutive day of the federal government shutdown, it's wonderful to think of these local areas taking matters into their own hands and making sure that everybody has a chance to thrive in the 21st century economy.
And you write that we may have, when we think about this, kind of a failure of imagination. In the same way that we thought the electricity was the power to light bulbs in our house, we think of that connectivity as, okay, we play an online game, we stream some music, we post the cat video, whatever. You say economically and socially, there are like benefits we can't even think of yet until we have this kind of thing in place.
That's true, and we're an enormous market. If we got this right in the United States, if all these municipal networks eventually, and by the way, there are 800 different either municipal or cooperative networks in the United States these days, if that shaved the federal government into action, imagine all the kinds of things we could be doing. You could work where you live rather than having to live where you work. We could really address climate change by perhaps moving people out of harm's way into communities that are well-served by communications, where they can have wonderful jobs, get a first-class education for their kids, no matter where they are, fantastic health services. But there's much more beyond that that, as you said, we really can't imagine, because nobody yet in the world has had access to a large market with new forms of fiber-based services. And the Chinese are going really fast and moving towards that, and I have hope that the United States will get the idea that we need to speed up.
We're talking to Susan Crawford from Harvard Law School. She's the author of the new book we're talking about. It's called Fiber, The Coming Tech Revolution and Why America Might Miss It.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What's the internet connection like in your area? If you live in a rural area, do you have access to reliable broadband? Would you support a nationwide fiber network the same way we have power lines and networks? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@WPR.org.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Conner. We continue our conversation with Susan Crawford. She is a professor at Harvard Law School and the author of the new book, Fiber, The Coming Tech Revolution and Why America Might Miss It.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What would you like to see change in our internet-connected world? Would you support a nationwide network of fiber optic cable, kind of like we have had for some time with electricity? If you live in a rural area, I'd love to hear from you. Do you have access to reliable internet at any speed? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lots of callers. Let's start with Ben in Lake Forest, Illinois. Ben, hi, what did you want to bring up?
Well, just a couple of things. First of all, I think it's important to emphasize that the existing telecommunications monopolies actually, in return for getting deregulation, agreed to put in fiber and reneged on most of those commitments. That's, I think, something important to remember here. So the fact that they were never enforced is, I think, should interest people. The second thing is this, that, you know, there's also been, there's sort of like a race between how to use, say, something existing like copper more efficiently because of improvements in processing technology. In other words, to get more bandwidth out of existing stuff versus being able to use fiber and get the whole shebang to start with. And what's happened is that the existing telecom actors, of course, are trying to avoid spending any money on new infrastructure by playing that particular game. On the other hand, if people could actually, with some of these technologies, build their own local neighborhood networks and deal on a wholesale basis instead of at a retail basis with a telecom company. I mean, there are.
Ben, I'm gonna jump. We've got a lot of callers. You gave us a lot to work with, Susan. First of all, his history talking about deregulation for fiber. We got the deregulation. We didn't get the fiber. Is that about right?
There have been a lot of Lucy with the football moments in telecom history. Yes, and at the moment they're sitting very pretty with complete deregulation.
Ben, thanks a lot for the call. He also mentioned telecoms trying to squeeze what they can out of existing copper wire or coaxial cable, where that is. Not so much with spending money to bring in fiber optic cable. Is that something you see?
Yeah, and that's sensible from their perspective. Again, sweating the copper is what it's called. They just want to get as much out of it before they have to upgrade to a new kind of network. They're under no requirement from the government and no competitive force from the private market. So we sort of have the worst of both worlds, a kind of private utility that can do whatever it wants.
Thanks again for the call, Ben. We go now to Mike in Oconomowoc. Mike, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to kind of echo what your guest is saying, and I've been in this game for a long time, actually doing private fiber to the home and fiber to the unit business as a project director throughout the United States, and on the Google Fiber project, the AT&T Light Gig Fiber project, and then here in the state. And what I'm finding is that there's sort of a double-edged sword. We all want the fiber. We just don't want somebody digging in our front yard. Or we don't have the municipalities that want to necessarily take the risk of having people, you know, digging as much and that. And then you have that generational gap where you have a certain segment of the population that says, you know, I really don't know what good it would do me to have higher speed.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Susan, your thoughts on Mike's experiences?
I think he's exactly right. And so the Swedes, very sensible and very neat people, decided if you dig up the streets just once and put in a wholesale, it's called dark fiber facility, then you have a whole bunch of competitors share it, and you never have to dig up the streets again. And they did that when they had incumbent cable and telco providers already on the scene because they wanted to avoid the mess. So he's absolutely right about that. He's also right that, you know, people were rolling around electric kitchens in the Irish countryside in the 60s. It took a long time to convince people that electricity was worthwhile in the home. And we're seeing the same thing with very high-capacity Internet access these days.
Mike, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234, talking with Susan Crawford, author of the book Fiber, The Coming Tech Revolution and Why America Might Miss It. Back to your calls now. Colin is with us in Green Bay. Colin, hi.
Hi. I just had a quick question. My brother-in-law, she lives in Longmont, Colorado, so they have municipal fiber. So I had actually reached out to my local legislator to see if they had even thought about bringing something to the table or anything in that regard. So I guess my question is, and he said no. He said there is nothing on the table. It's not even being thought about. So from a citizen's perspective, what do I need to do, or like what can a citizen do to kind of get the ball rolling at the municipal level to try and get that fiber to a, you know, a smaller town? I'm technically from the pier, so it's about, you know, 25,000 people. But what would need to be done, I guess, like what would the process be to create a pitch to say this is why it would be necessary?
Interesting, Colin. Thanks a lot. So, Susan, what could Colin do in De Pere or anyone in a local community?
Well, Colin's question is terrific, and luckily this whole community is extremely friendly and communicative. So there are small-town municipal utilities in Wisconsin that would be delighted to get on the phone and get you started with information, maybe come give a presentation, might be willing to come in and help you do a feasibility study. What you're really trying to do is give the politicians air cover for what may require bonding, you know, actually raising money to build this initial wholesale dark fiber network. And it's not always easy. So look at Madison that spent years looking at this and did the study, did the feasibility work, and then decided it was just too expensive for the city to raise the bonds, to put out the bonds to raise the money to build the wholesale network. And that politically was just a no-go. And that may happen in your town, but the first step is to just learn as much as you can from very friendly people across the state. Also, there's a wonderful website called muninetworks.org and the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. There's a terrific guy close by, Christopher Mitchell, in Minnesota, who is very aware of the situation in Wisconsin and would be delighted to be helpful. So this is a good time to be thinking about this subject.
Colin, thanks for that call. Going out to Parker with us in Rio. Parker, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Parker?
I live in a small town, which is Rio, kind of 1,000 people, and I still have DSL. I don't even get the cable where I live, and now with what happened with net neutrality, I have to pay for 10 megabytes here to get the faster speed.
Parker, thanks for that call. Yeah, still no cable. He said he has to pay a lot to get a faster speed. He's not alone in rural America, right, Susan?
No, in fact, a lot of rural America doesn't have cable at all. They're still dealing with those old copper wires that have never been upgraded. And the telephone companies like CenturyLink and Verizon and AT&T have really backed off from installing wires and are trying to push everybody over to wireless access in rural areas. So there are a lot of shenanigans going on. But again, nothing bad about these companies. We just haven't exerted a strong hand in helping the nation towards a brighter future.
Thanks for the call, Parker. Time for one more call. Dave is with us in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Dave.
Hey, how's it going? So, great topic. I live out in the country. I have terrible high-speed access. I'm on a satellite. I can't stand it. My question is, will fiber become less of an issue with 5G on the way?
Oh, great question. So these two things are utterly complementary. You can't have a wireless communication without a wire somewhere nearby saying, let's rely on wireless. We don't need wires like saying, let's just use airplanes. Who needs airports? The wireless signal has to go somewhere. And so without really fiber going deep into neighborhoods and into houses, 5G just isn't going to function because you have to have the cells are very, very close together, and you'll have a lot of data going through them. the fiber needs to be nearby. So these two things march together. And in fact, the book, Fiber, is about advanced wireless and fiber because we love wireless. We're going to rely on it. But without a great fiber connection nearby, you won't have those 5G connections.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Susan, in just our last few moments, clearly a lot of people aren't thinking about this yet. Do you see that maybe changing soon in the United States?
I think it will change. I think it's going to require a lot of this local activity and the real evidence of a crisis, and then a real leader who's experienced this. Eisenhower had a bump across the country at 6 miles an hour after the World War I, and that gave him the feeling that maybe we needed a national highway system. These are utterly bipartisan issues, and a leader who gets what a problem this is will, in fact, take charge and do something about it, not by nationalizing these companies, but by insisting that there's a public option everywhere in the country.
Susan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's my distinct pleasure. I love even thinking about Wisconsin. It's great.
That's Susan Crawford from Harvard Law School. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Fiber, The Coming Tech Revolution and Why America Might Miss It.